Well, this time of year, you know, maybe a week or so ago, there's probably opportunity to watch a show or two where there was the year in review, in a sense, you know, what took place over the last 12 months. And I thought we'd kind of do something like that, but I'm going to go back a little bit further. My list of events here is not all-inclusive by any stretch. But I just want to get us into a mode of thinking. If we go back to the mid-1700s through the mid-1800s, it's called the Industrial Revolution. And God had allowed man at that time to start producing things in mass quantity like never before. Factories all of a sudden started coming online. Items that most people used to have to have or used to have to make on their own now were being manufactured, shipped, and then sold in stores. A little bit more convenience. A lot of new items came to be because of this. You know, things that weren't necessarily needs anymore, now there were some wants, you know, coming into play. Jumping ahead a little bit, you've heard the term of the Roaring Twenties. People are enjoying life to some extent because of these new things. Life is a little bit more easy on a day-to-day level. Plumbing had come into play to some extent. Electric had come into play to some extent, not fully. But again, if you wanted or needed something, you might have to wait a little bit, but you could probably get your hands on it. But then the Great Depression came. And that probably was one of the poorest eras for the U.S. If you heard the term the Dust Bowl, you know, the middle of the U.S. went through a bit of a drought. The prairie lands and all of that. The buffalo had been almost extinguished by the settlers. And so there was a big portion of land in this country that had went through a major change. Now, the buffalo weren't roaming around through it the way they used to. And the native plants went through quite a change because of that. And the Dust Bowl come along, and things were very dry for a period of time, and lots of dust being blown around. And we were still self-reliant when it came to food. You know, even though there was stores, for the most part, your food came from what you could put on the table, for the most part. And during the 20s, if you lived in the cities, because crop production was down, there was a lot of times the store shelves were very empty. There wasn't new jobs to be had. A lot of people being laid off or let go. But then the 1940s come along. And in 1941, on December 7th, Pearl Harbor was bombed. And the U.S. didn't, in one sense, see that coming. It was a huge shock that any of our soil anywhere, even though it was well off from the mainland, that anybody would come and bomb us. Of course, along with Pearl Harbor, we entered into World War II. Atomic bombs were dropped. The Cold War began. The Holocaust. Because of World War II, women were brought into the workplace in mass numbers. You know, most able-bodied females now here on the mainland, because most of the males were caught up in the draft and shipped overseas. Now a lot of the females weren't at home being moms or housewives. They were at work in the factories. That played a role in just society, period. The 50s come along, and because of the war and production, things like that, things were getting better. And all of a sudden, we have a baby boom. We have housing and highways popping up literally almost overnight in quantity. Fidel Castro overthrows a dictatorship down in Cuba. On the television is I Love Lucy, George Burns, Gracie Allen, Gunsmoke, Father Knows Best, and Alfred Hitchcock. That was my phone. And Elvis was on the Ed Sullivan Show, but they couldn't show him from the waist down because of some of his moves. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. And the very first satellite was put into space, Sputnik. All of these things, and the Vietnam War starts in 55. All of these things had some major implements to society. 1960s, travel expands from ships and trains now to planes. Planes bring in things that we've never had before almost overnight, like bananas. I remember as a kid, I was born in 66, so this is the late 60s to very early 70s. I remember that we really looked forward to that time when the stores had bananas in stock. It wasn't year-round. And then I remember in the late 70s, all of a sudden realizing that, hey, we could only get peaches in like midsummer. And now they're here in February. And now when we go into the stores, we have almost any fruit or vegetable you want year-round, no matter what, because it's shipped in, overnight from wherever it needs to be so that we can enjoy it almost the next day on our table. 1960s, a man on the moon. Woodstock. TV shows that were very popular then, Andy Griffith, Gilligan's Island, Flintstones, and Bewitched. We had some assassinations. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. Again, all things that had huge impacts on society. 1970s, we had the Vietnam War protest. Kent State. Police officers opened fire on unarmed students. Watergate. Nixon resigns. Roe versus Wade. Ted Bundy is in the news as a mass serial killer. On the TV is All in the Family with Archie Bunker. He said some things. MASH was on the TV. Good times. Good Times, we didn't watch that show very much, but I remember the very sharp contrast, even to my life. Jimmy and his family lived in an apartment. Their dad worked hard, but could never keep a job. He was changing jobs, it seemed like, all the time. And I remember some of the conversation would be about food and how little of it there was and how hard it was to get for them. They were poor, living in the city in an apartment. And my family was probably below the poverty line, but I didn't feel like they did. Also on TV at that time was Maud. She had a lot to say and shared it. On the big screen was Star Wars and Jaws. Then the 1980s come along. Does anybody remember the day MTV launched? So most of you, a lot of you are too young, right? I was there when we turned on the TV and we were literally waiting for the next few minutes for it to finally launch. Me and a friend literally watched that first day. That shaped society. The first major consumer computer, it wasn't the only computer, comes into my school. I was in, I believe this was seventh grade, and my school got two Tandy TRS-80s. Steve's shaking it, nodding his head. Do you remember those? You don't remember. You're too young, I think. My grandma was, she always thought technology and just things moving forward was a good thing, that you needed to keep up with that. And so she went out to Radio Shack and she bought a TRS-80 when they first hit the shelves. And she wanted me and my sister to be exposed to computers because she felt like they were going to become truly part of our future. Wow, how right she was. But at that time, that computer literally did nothing. There was a cassette tape you could plug in. On that cassette tape, as part of the little package of software that came with it. When I say little, I can't describe because I just know it was very, very small, limited memory, was the Oregon Trail. And most of us are aware of the Oregon Trail, but this was text only. Very, very dumbed down text because they couldn't put that many characters into the game. When I say characters, text characters. So it was very dumbed down. And it would ask you a very simple question, and you basically got to answer a yes or no. Or maybe how many. You could put it between 1 and 10. You can't do triple digits here. That was about the only thing we could do with that is play Oregon Trail when that first came out. During the 80s, there was an assassination attempt on our president, Reagan. I remember coming home one day and from school, and my mom has the TV on. Mom never had the TV on. So I knew something's up. What's going on? They tried to kill our president. The last time that happened was in the 60s, and they did kill our president. And so my mom's generation was concerned. What's going to take place? Because the last assassination on the president had a huge impact on our society. That same President Reagan went to Gorbachev and said, "Tear down these walls." And the Berlin Wall came down. Divorce hits an all-time high. Maybe because why it peaked then and started actually going down? Because fewer people were getting married. In 2011, there were 16.3 marriages per 1,000 women. Think about that. In 2021, that number had declined to 14.9 out of 1,000 women. The internet comes along in the 80s. Netscape, AOL, you've got mail. Bag phones came out. I had to wait a bit, but I got a bag phone. And shortly after that, the ability to converse with almost anybody in the world at any time was right here and now. Live Aid and We Are the World. Remember those? And the epidemic AIDS was identified. 1990s, Columbine High School. Persian Gulf War. The Murrow Building in Oklahoma City bombed with a daycare in the bottom of it. The iPhone comes out. Going into the 2000s, iTunes comes out. Napster and other music share platforms are taken down. I'm into music. There was a lot going on with music at that time. September 11th happened. Nobody in this country saw that coming. Couldn't even imagine that happening. Along with that, the Iraq War. Barack Obama's elected president, first black president. 2010s, Britain decides it no longer wants to be a part of the Union. Brexit. Mass shootings. Seems like we hear about one almost every day, don't we? This is just in the 2010s. And there's the 2016 election. What a day for popcorn, right? 2017, the U.S. president decides to move the Israeli embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And then more recently, the 20s come along, COVID. I just went through a very, very, very tiny list of major events that took place in some of our lives and didn't even really touch on how they shaped or formed or maneuvered or shifted thinking, platforms, education, finances, I mean, healthcare. All of it got shaped by these things. But think of how each one of these mattered. Because one way or another, they mattered. One thing that we should consider is that as big as some of these challenges were, the vast majority of individuals that went through those challenges lived through those challenges to face the next challenge. So part of the message I want to make sure I push along here is there's going to be more challenges. We don't give up because it's not over till it's over, right? But there is more to come. There's one thing that's been on my mind, you know, for a big handful of years now that I know, you probably know even if you hadn't really thought about it, is due to come, but it's not here yet. In 2011, our family went out to the spring holidays out west. and I got to sit down with a friend at dinner, and I had to ask him, I said, I know where you work, but I don't know what you do. What do you do? What's your job description? What's your title? He says, well, I kind of don't have one. I said, okay, so what do you do? Well, I kind of do anything I want. What's that mean? And he says, well, I'm in product development, and they kind of just let me alone in hopes that I come up with something that will be beneficial to the company. And, okay, that's starting to make more sense. So what are you working on? He says, well, right now, he says, not so much, because we just launched a product that I helped invent or put together, that the launch was just literally a couple months before this. And he says, that's taking up a lot of my time in terms of talking with major customers for this product, how they could better use it, you know, what its limitations are, things like that. I said, okay. He says, so right now, he says, I'm a little bit more of a consultant. I said, okay. He's in the IT business. And the product that him and his company had just launched, and when I say him, and he is, he's very humble. So he's not taking more credit than what he deserves, probably not enough credit. But the product that they had just launched was a small octagon room. In that room, I think it was 8 feet across. So if you picture an octagon, in the center of that room is kind of a tall mast or a post, and it's a rope. That post is a robot, and it has two arms with grabbers in a sense. And the wall, the eight walls, it's fully enclosed, have stacks and stacks and stacks of magnetic tape cassettes. And if I remember right, at that time, those cassettes held somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think, 250 terabytes apiece. So this is mass data storage. And the job of the robot was to pull cassettes off the wall. And I don't remember how many were in this small octagon room, but there was several readers. The robot would pull a cassette and plug it into a reader. And when the reader was done with it, it would pull it back out and plug it back into its resting position. And all day long, that's what it did. This was huge. From the standpoint, prior to that, technology hadn't developed a system to store massive quantities of electronic data in one spot and access it quickly from the same spot. And I asked him, I said, so who's interested in buying this product, this room? He says, well, you know, the armed forces are, our military wants it. And have already placed orders for it. I said, okay, well, I get that. And he says, but the first industry that contacted us that wanted it like right now. Take a wild guess in your mind. Who would want mass data storage right now first? Hollywood. Hollywood wanted it. Why? Because you remember the phrase that when the producer or the director says, cut? He means stop the camera right now. Don't let another inch of film go through that camera. Why? Because film was extremely expensive. But now Hollywood could let a camera, they could turn on a camera first thing in the morning, let it literally run all day long. Not just during the take, but during the outtakes. I mean, during every, just let it run. They don't care because they can store all of this footage in one device. And almost instantaneous, or I mean, within just a few months of that, we started seeing movies with these long out-trailings of outtakes. For the very first time, we never had before. Prior to the, you know, prior to 2000, probably about 12 or 13, we didn't see outtakes hardly ever because that footage was never taken. It was, you know, obliterated. But I asked my friend, I said, so, you know, where's this going? And he says, well, we kind of don't know. He never brought up this term to me, the cloud. But the cloud was made possible because of this device. Because now corporations like Google, whoever, could now store huge amounts of data in one place and retrieve it kind of quickly. I asked him, I said, so what does your industry, IT, you know, computers, whatever, there must be some type of benchmark or goal for the future. You know, what do you want to see, or what do you expect to see in 10 years from now? He says, well, we do set benchmarks as an industry. But he says, you know, those are very difficult to achieve. They're just kind of goals. And he says, and we just passed one of those benchmarks. I said, well, what do you mean? He says, our abilities to store vast amounts of data in one place, we didn't think we'd be able to do that for another 20 years. He says, we're way ahead of the curve on this. And I said, okay, so what's next? He says, there's one huge problem that still exists, and it still exists today. We do not have a way to take that mass amount of storage, pick it up, and send it across the world instantaneously. And that's the reason, you know, we keep hearing about these platforms with satellites where they want to have a fleet of trucks that are autonomous. We really can't do it yet, because right now the truck, the single truck, has to be autonomous. But once we can communicate vast amounts of digital data through the satellite system instantaneously, now a single company can oversee, manage, run, operate hundreds of trucks all around the world at the exact same time from one location. We can't do that at the moment. And whenever they figure out a way to make this transportation of mass data, when they unlock the keys to that, we think the internet is beyond our thinking now. I mean, that is truly going to change how life works. Because just in transportation, the planes, the airlines that we fly in will be run by a computer. You know, in one sense, we won't need tower control. You know, dispatching, you know, for semis. Will our car really go anywhere we want it to? Maybe not. We probably will have to say, okay, today at this time, I want to go here. And we have to jump in and allow it to take us to there. And it will choose the route, the speed. Maybe, I don't know. So there's still big things, you know, coming. But we don't know what's coming next. And we certainly don't know how it's going to affect us, society, whoever. It's not simply over the next years or decades, what, you know, what's coming or how is it going to come about. But what about next month? What about next week? What about the next hour? Do we really know what's coming? We don't. Again, remember, those that have lived through these major events lived through them and went on to the next event and the next event. So we don't give up just because this event seems, oh, I wasn't expecting this. This is too much for me. No, it probably isn't. So, again, this time of year, people are making some goals. Maybe by this time of year, they've already stopped pursuing the goal. But shouldn't we, as well, have some long-term goals in our personal life? Of course, I'm not talking so much about just for ourselves, meaning our physical body, but what about spiritual goals? We know things are already very bad, and they're only going to get worse. We probably should consider, as we look at our potential future, how should we navigate any and all the events that could be in our future? Go to Matthew 24. I'll say this every time I turn to this. This is a chapter you have to be extremely familiar with. Jesus has been talking to a crowd, gets done, and now he's going to spend a little bit of time just kind of one-on-one with the disciples. Matthew 24 and verse 1, and as Jesus came out of the temple and was going away, his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple, and he asked them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I tell you, not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." And of course, in their mind's eye, it's like, how can this happen? These just got built, and it took a lot of effort to put these big stones one on top of another. And you're saying they're just going to all come down? And then the why. Why would that happen? Much like the thinking of September 10th. Verse 3, Matthew 24. When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us then, will this be? When will this be? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "Beware that no one leads you astray." So the very first words out of his mouth as a response to when will this be, and what will the signs of your coming be of the end age, his first words are, "Beware that no one leads you astray." So what did he really just tell them? And it wasn't to just them, it was to us also. Keep your focus and faith on me. It's that simple. Beware that no one leads you away. Keep your focus on Christ. And put all of your faith on God. Verse 5. For many will come in my name saying, "I am the Messiah," and they will lead many astray. Led astray. That sounds bad, like that's the wrong thing, right? So if I'm not led astray, what he really just said was bad things will be happening around me, but not necessarily to me. Do not be led astray. Keep your focus on him. Verse 6, and when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, see that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. We will hear, because we will be alive through the wars and the rumors of wars. They are not to be our focus. turn CNN, ABC, CBS, NBC, Glenn Beck, Carson Tucker, you're still going to hear about the news. You don't need to be focused on all that stuff. We're to be focused on God, where He wants us to be, what He wants us to be doing, and how He wants us to be doing it. He said, don't be alarmed. It means do not change or alter your plans based simply upon your feelings, your emotions. That will always lead you astray. Remember the phrase, our hearts are desperately wicked. But again, what he just told us is, this is not the end. There are still things God wants us to do. Verse 7, for nation will rise up against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of this is but the beginning of birth pangs. Again, we're being told what will be taking place around us, maybe right next door to us, but it does not harm us. Remember Jacob and Joseph were spared through the famine because they followed God. Remember the widow, was spared by God through Elijah from the famine. There was food for all in her house until the famine had ceased. Matthew 24 and verse 9. Then they will hand you over to be tortured and will put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. Now we're told that we may have to suffer because of our beliefs. This is not something to be fearful of. It sounds scary, but we need to put this very much into context. God said that He will not put anything upon us that we cannot handle. Some things I can handle, and some things the next person beside me won't be able to handle, and vice versa. The other thing is, He's never going to leave us standing there by ourselves during these kind of events. Go to Luke 22 and verse 42. Christ was not fearful about what was going to happen. He didn't like what was going to have to happen. And so he goes to the Father and he says, if you are willing, Father, remove this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done. And then in verse 43, then an angel from heaven appeared to him and gave him strength. God is not going to allow us to stand there by ourselves. It might be in front of a firing squad, at a gallows, but he's going to be right beside us and he's going to somehow, miraculously, get us through that event. Go to Acts 7. Acts 7 and verse 59. And while they were stoning Stephen, he prayed, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Then he knelt down and cried out in a loud voice, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. When he had said this, he died. Stephen understood that God was right there beside him, that he could still call out to him, and that the biggest thing, Stephen understood, I'm still supposed to be doing his will, which is loving others. And he said, Father, don't condemn them because of this. I don't have the words to try to convey to you, but I'm convinced now that in our very last moments, God very much is more present than we've ever experienced him in our entire lives, in our very last moments, he is more present than he has ever been in our lives. He will somehow get us through that moment, because it is kind of scary, because we don't know what it's supposed to feel like. I'm sure we're not going to experience what we think we're going to experience. Death, physical death, is not the worst case scenario. We shouldn't be afraid of that. I don't want it to happen in the next few minutes, the next few hours, the next few years. I'm hoping that God has placed on my head a number of days that takes me beyond 80. When I turned 50, I told him, I said, okay, Father, I said, the first 50 weren't so bad. I'm ready for the next 50. I don't know if he's got 50 more, if he had 50 more planned for me. I'm not worried about it. But one of the things we must keep in mind with death is God has prescribed a number of days for each one of us. And if my days, let's say that my days are now 7 years, 2 months, and 6 days out from now. The next round of COVID can't get me next year. Whatever it is, out on the highway, wherever I go, it's not going to get me. But the opposite's true too. On that day, in that hour, in that minute, God said, no, this is the cutoff. And there is no medication that will save you. That's what Moses experienced. In one sense, physically, it wasn't his time. His body could have went another handful of years, a couple more decades, I don't know. But God says, no, this is your time. And we don't hear, read, or suspect from Moses' writings that he was in fear of this. I know he was disappointed that he didn't get to walk into the promised land. He did get to see it, and he knew that within just a day or a few days of his death that the Israelites would be crossing over. He knew, yes, this, God has fulfilled his promise. But in terms of his death, I don't think it was an unpleasant experience. I don't think Stephen's death was an unpleasant experience. I think there was a lot of unknowns. But for Stephen, God had said, I'm going to place you here in front of these people at this time. And you're actually going to have the opportunity to give a message about me. I hope you're willing to give the message. And he was. We should not fear physical death. When the number of our days is up, we will be put in the grave, the safest place we can be for the moment. Stop and consider that. Satan has zero ability over the dead. Zero. He don't care about the dead. He's not going to do anything with the dead. But God is. Because what Satan cannot do, God can do. God can raise up the dead. And Satan knows that. Because God loves us, Satan does not care for us at all. All he wants is to have vengeance against God. That's all he wants. He uses us as pawns. But our Father in heaven loves us so much that he and he alone will raise us up and place us in his Son's kingdom where Satan has been defeated. Satan does not make any promises at all towards future. He just wants to use and abuse. It's not over till it's over. We still have days left. Some of us hopefully have many decades left. Matthew 24 and verse 10. Then many will fall away, and they will betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray, and because of the increase of lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. So what Christ just here reminds us, back to his first sentence, we can't allow ourselves to be distracted. If we allow ourselves to be distracted from God, then we have allowed ourselves to walk toward and straight into Satan's trap. We're just one of his throwaway pawns. We are going to have to put forth energy, effort, and endurance. God will give us the strength, just as he did Christ that very last night. It's going to require us to remain focused on God, have faith in his plan for us. Verse 14, and this good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. So for some, or many, as we endure and continue in God's will, there's going to be great opportunity to watch a huge transformation of many. Not only are we going to get to watch this transformation, but we're going to get to be a part of that transformation. Over the last few years, I've been shocked at just how many, and technology is an aid in this, so maybe the numbers are skewed just from the lack of historical data, we'll say. But you know, over the last few years, how many people are coming out of the Sunday keeping faith? And they're looking for God, the real God. They're looking into his word and trying to figure out, what does he want me to do? Why does he have me here? Why does he love me this much? And what we just read is that those numbers are going to continue to increase exponentially. I mean, hugely. That's the reason we're supposed to be examples, edifiers, encouragers of the word. But we cannot proclaim without knowing God or allowing God to guide us as to who and how to proclaim. So we have to know his word. And I know some of you are on a yearly reading plan, some of you are on a 3-month plan. Every day you got to be in his word. Be sure you know exactly what he has told us, left us, guided us with. That's his first communication with us. Verse 15, so when you see the desolation sacrilege standing in the holy place, as it is spoken by the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. The one on the housetop must not go down to take what is in the house. The one in the field must not turn back to get a coat. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. Again, here we see that I didn't write this very good. We will hear and know what we need to hear and know despite the news coverage. They're not going to warn us to be at the right place at the right time. Only God will do that. So we can't stay focused on the news, no matter how good you might think a Glenn Beck or Tucker Carlson or anybody else is, we can't remain focused on them. They're not going to tell us where we need to be how we need to get there, when we need to be there. God will do that. We should have had way more than enough evidence by now that Satan utilizes the airwaves, the news, to spread his lies. But in this passage, we're seeing that God is guiding those that could be in harm's way, how he would have them escape, where he would have them escape to, and how they're going to be protected. Going forward, we can't just simply ask God for his guidance. We're going to have to be willing to heed and do it. We may be asked to go someplace that seems or sounds unpleasant to us. Maybe the distance will be farther than what we really want to travel. Maybe the mode of transportation won't be it. You might want to put us all on camels. You willing to jump on top of a camel? Will you remember that he will provide for us in miraculous way as long, in miraculous ways as long as we remain in his will? Will you remember the waters of Meribah? The Israelites are out in the wilderness. They need water. And out of a rock, he brought forth water. They were hungry for meat, and he provided quail. They needed sustenance, and he provided manna 6 days a week for decades. Their clothes didn't wear out. We need to be prepared for tough times. And this passage reminds us to pray to God. It literally says, pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath. Ask him to bless the ways that he's going to protect us. Verse 21. For at that time there will be great suffering, such as not has been from the beginning of the world until now. No, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no one would be saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Another reminder here of just how much God loves us. He's not going to put us into something that we can't handle. But he's also telling us that he will protect us in any means he needs to, and that may include physical death. But he's protecting our spiritual life. Because he loves us so greatly, he wants us with him for eternity. Verse 23. Then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Messiah, or there he is, do not believe it. For false messiahs and false prophets will appear and produce great signs and omens to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Take note, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he is in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. Satan's deception tactics are going to be huge and on all of the news channels. Look what happened today at this location. Hear what was said by this person. It's all going to be on the news. We need to be prepared so that we don't fall into the trap that Pharaoh's men are just as capable as God. If for whatever reason you walk up to a lake and you see the waters part and someone says, Christ is there on the other side, go to him, are you going to do it? I hope not, because he just told us, don't do it. And the reality is, he says, even the elect, for the elect's sake, That means those of us that are diligent, our faith level is way up there. We are going to see and hear things that will look miraculous to us. We may see someone truly walking on water. That's not our opportunity to say, oh, that must be him. He's warning us in advance, don't fall for it. What he's really saying is, don't do anything without his guidance. And along with his guidance, remember what his word is and dwell in it. Verse 27, Matthew 24. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there is the vultures will gather. Now we are warned to watch only for the real signs of Christ's return. Signs that will only be in the air. Verse 29. Immediately after the suffering of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Where at? Not on earth. Not on the other side of the parted waters. Not on top of the water. But in heaven. We're going to be looking up. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds from one end of heaven to the other. No CNN needed, period. No matter where you're at, you will not escape seeing what's taking place or hearing it. It'll be in the sky. Verse 36, but about that day and hour no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as in those days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away, so too will be the coming of the Son of Man. We may not know, but we can be guided to. We can be guided to the correct place at the correct time, just as a blind person can be led through a very large, crowded auditorium. Think about that. The blind person knows where the goal is at, on the opposite side of the auditorium, but they can't see how to best get there. And then as they're being led, it's a zigzag, isn't it? Because that aisle is a lot more blocked than this aisle over here, so we'll take this aisle. Now let's cheat through this row of chairs. There's a chair in the way, let me move that. The blind man just has to simply have 100% faith that the person leading him will get him to the other side of the auditorium. Despite all these obstacles. And all along, shoulders are bumping against shoulders. You're hearing things that maybe sound like it's the opposite of what's true in the moment. So, should we have a goal or resolution? Yeah, we should. It should be to truly turn all of the rest of our lives over to God. Not just some, or what I think is the big things, but everything, and especially including the small things. Joshua took over for Moses when he died. And Joshua was a pretty upright guy, but he flubbed up once, at least once. We're going to read about that. Joshua 9, verse 1. Now when all the kings who had were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland and all among along the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittites and the Amorites and Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites heard of his, they gathered together with one accord to fight Joshua and Israel. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard that Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they were on their part acted and cunning. They went and prepared provisions and took worn out sacks for their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended, with worn out patched sandals on their feet and worn out clothes. And all their provisions were dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal. And they said to him and the Israelites, "We have come from a far country, so now make a treaty with us." But the Israelites said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you live among us, and then how can we make a treaty with you?" Because God had told them to clear out the land. And they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you, and where do you come from?" And they said to him, "Your servants have come from a very far country because of the name of the Lord your God, for we have heard a report of him, of all that he did in Egypt." In verse 10, "And all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites and who were beyond the Jordan, King Sihon of Heshbon and King Og of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country said to us, 'Take provisions in your hand from the journey, go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Come now, make a treaty with us. Here's our bread. It was still warm when we took it from our houses as for food for the journey on the day we set out to come to you. But now, see, it is dry and moldy. These wineskins were new when we filled them, and see, they are burst, and these garments and sandals of ours are worn out from the very long journey.' So the leaders partook of their provisions and did not ask direction from the Lord." God had promised them the promised land, not other lands. And these guys come along claiming that they're from much, much further away, so not of the promised land, and saying that they're afraid because Joshua's God might come and harm them. So they want a treaty. Joshua's ears should have been paying more attention. The other leaders should have been paying more attention, because what they asked was, in a sense, nothing, of no meaning, no value. No treaty needed. We're not headed that direction. Verse 15, "Joshua made peace with them, guaranteeing their lives as a treaty, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. But when 3 days had passed after they had made a treaty with them, they heard that they were their neighbors, and they were living among them." So the leaders, Joshua, apparently thought that their kindness, their love, their concern, their perception, discernment, knowledge, wisdom, would be flawless in this matter, which seemed very small in their eyes. So they did not consult God. When God is neglected in the large or small things, the ripple effect is huge. It can go on for generations in your family. It can affect all of society. Verse 17, "So the Israelites set out and reached their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon, Shephirah, Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim. But the Israelites did not attack them, because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, that all the congregation murmured against the leader. Then all the congregation murmured against the leaders. Are we supposed to swear using God's name? Make an oath. They had to keep it. They had to uphold it. But they weren't to make that oath. Verse 19, but the leader said to the congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we must not touch them. This is what we will do to them. We will let them live so that wrath may not come upon us because of the oath that we have sworn to them. And the leader said to them, let them live. So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation, as the leaders had decided concerning them. And Joshua summoned them and said to them, why did you deceive us, saying, we are very far from you, while in fact you are living among us? Now therefore you are cursed. Some of you shall always be slaves, hewers of wood, drawers of water, for the house of my God. Why do the Palestinians or any other people think they have a right to Israel? Because someone didn't consult God. Because the promised land was not entered as God prescribed. God wants to give us our inheritance in full. If we choose not to acknowledge and treat him as God, our God, the one and only God, then there is no inheritance for us. We need to be treating him as God and allowing him to guide us in every single step as if we're blind. We're not. It's not that we can't make choices. But on a very regular basis, and when I say regular basis, hourly, we should be in contact with him. Father, is this the right decision for me? Should I keep moving forward on this, or should I detour? We have to be teaching our kids all of this. Our grandchildren all of this. They must know that they can have complete faith in God. We also must be teaching at every opportunity as it arises those around us that you can have complete faith in God. Things are getting harder. They're going to get worse. But we can all be led so that we are spiritually unscathed. God has us here in this moment for a reason. He's determined the number of days ahead of us. Are we going to live out that number of days to the fullest of his glory? Or are we just going to seek our own? So how can we make sure that we are turning our entire life over to God and his will? Well, I kind of already said it. But I think at minimum, 3 times a day, we should be checking in with him. Not simply with, Father, I want this, this, and this, but with the question, am I still inside of your will? If I'm not, will you guide me back onto the path? I phrase that on a regular basis. Father, just close the door. Make me bump my stupid nose on the door so that I don't go through it. Let me realize you don't want me to go that direction any longer. And then guide me back to the path, you know, that you want me on. So when we wake, maybe during our breakfast or over coffee, maybe on the drive to work, Father, is there anything you would have me alter, do, or be aware of today? Because it's not a problem for that we schedule our lives out. But are we willing to say, Father, I'm willing to alter the schedule that I'm aware of at the moment to your glory? I'm willing to make any detour, no matter how far, no matter how bad the location, I'm willing to make the sacrifice. at lunchtime. Thank him for the hours that you've been awake. Tell him of your concerns. It's not that we shouldn't have emotions. We just don't let our emotions control us. So let him know when we're angry at something, when we're afraid of something, we're concerned about something. We got some news that kind of distressing. Father, guide me through this new situation. And again, ask him, is there anything you would have me do, alter, or be aware of? Then before we go to bed, thank him for the day. And ask him to guide your future, not simply tomorrow's, but all the way into eternity. We need to turn our entirety of our lives over to God. Allow him to lead us wherever he wants, through whatever he wants, when and wherever he wants. Remember, Satan has lost out on his opportunity for eternal life. He wants to see, do anything he can to make us miss out on the same opportunity. So are we going to allow him to coax us into his hateful vengeance towards God? Or are we going to allow God to maneuver us towards eternal life? Every small event, every big event, moderate event, we should just quickly ask God, how do you want me to do this? Why? Because he will protect us. He will provide for us. He'll even bless us through all of the things that are coming. And he'll bring us to a new time. Revelation 21, verse 1. This is just a glimpse, a dream. Of course, our dreams are glimpses of something. Our thought of something, our mind's eye of something is never nowhere near the reality. It's a small percentage of what's there. So this is going to be even bigger and better than what is stated here. Revelation 21 and verse 1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, see, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them. They will be his people. And God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes, and death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. And the first things have been passed away.